Okay, good morning, everybody. I'm sorry that we're a little bit late. Somebody, for some reason, walked off with the copies that we made. So if you find who that is, you can have a word with him. So today we're going to talk about a very important halacha topic. As we know, we're just completing the Yom Tov of Hanukkah. And there's a question that comes up, a very practical question that is raised every single year, not only after Hanukkah, but after Sukkot as well, and after many other opportunities of mitzvah observance, and that is, generally, it's asked by the women, because the women care a lot more about getting the house back in order than the men do. So the question is raised, what do we do? How do we dispose of our Hanukkah menorah? And how do we get rid of this oil? And what do we do with all the wicks? And what do we do with our decorations from the sukkah? And what do we do with the schach and the panels? These are all wonderful questions, and that's what we're going to discuss today. And the question really breaks down into numerous categories. The first category is, while a person is in the midst of performing a mitzvah activity, whatever activity that might be it lighting the Neres Hanukkah, be it using the sukkah on the Yom Tov of Sukkot, while one is in the middle of using the mitzvah item, you are not allowed to derive benefit from it. That's what the Gemara tells us in Maseches Shabbos in the second parak. And the Gemara says the same thing applies both to Neres Hanukkah as well as a sukkah. So for example, what does it mean that you're not allowed to use the candles of Hanukkah for your own purposes? As we say, you have to go no further than Haneres Alalu. Haneres Alalu Kodeshem. One is not allowed to make personal private use out of the neiros that we light on Hanukkah. So what does that mean? What does it mean I'm not allowed to get private personal benefits? So the Mishnah Berurah writes, well, it doesn't mean that you're not allowed to use the light. Let's say I happen to enjoy a house that has lights in it. So you're going to say, well, today I have to close my eyes on Hanukkah while my candles are lit? Obviously not. Says the Mishnah Berurah, what it means is the following. Haneiros halalu kodeshem, the Mishnah Berurah writes, v'dafka bazeh. What do we mean, ein lana rishus lehishtamesh behem, that we're not allowed to use the candles for our own personal benefit, for our own purposes? He says, for example, kagon livdok mos. Let's say I'm looking through my wallet and I want to figure out, is this a $5 bill, is it a $10 bill, is it a $100 bill, and I can't see. So I go next to the candles. That, the Gemara says, and that's what we assume lahalacha, that's when we say, you are not allowed to use the candles for that. Or, limnosan, if I want to count the money that I have, also I'm not allowed to use the Hanukkah candles for that kind of purpose. Shehu al-kapanim tashmish aray. Avol, kol she'ena mishamish klum, rashar leisha bebeso. If I'm not really actively getting benefit from the candles, I'm just passively, I am who I am. I'm sitting in my house, I'm sitting on the couch. Happens to be, I enjoy the fact that there's light. Or the sharatzion adds. Let's say, for example, you have somebody who's walking around the living room, and the lights happen to be off. So now that I'm walking around, I don't want to bump into the table, I don't want to bump into the couch, into the furniture, the bookshelf. So it happens to be that my way of navigating around the room is by the fact that there's light from the Neres Hanukkah. So we assume in a case like that, that would be permissible because that's called really a passive kind of hano. That's called a passive kind of benefit that I'm getting. It's not really an active. If I go with my wallet and I start counting money, that's called an active benefit. That's what's not permissible. If I go just as a passive nature, so that is permissible. What you see from here is, let's say just you take for example, we do have a category of something called Isuri Hana, something which is totally off limits. For example, Chametz on Pesach, totally Asur Hana. Let's say for example, I own a store. I own a store and I sell chametz in the store. I own a bakery and I'm selling chametz. So not only do we say I'm not allowed to eat the chametz, not only do we say I'm not allowed to have it in my possession, even if I sell the store, I'm not allowed to get benefit from all the money that came in from the chametz that was sold over Pesach. So I'm not allowed to derive any kind of benefit from something in the category of Isuri Hana. But let's say you have over here, even though we say Ein Lana Rishus Lehishtamesh Bahem, which sounds like it's Isuri Hana, it sounds like it's off limits, just like chametz, we assume it's not exactly as severe. It's not really the same. And we would assume over here that you are allowed to get a passive benefit from it, just not actively getting, deriving pleasure and benefit from the candles. This is very similar to something that we find in the Gemara. The Gemara tells us, in the end of Maseches Sukkah, the Gemara says that by the Simchas Beis HaShoeva, on Chol HaMoed Sukkis, so they would have people would light up lights in the Beis HaMikdash and torches, and there was so much light, the Gemara says, even if you live miles and miles away, Isha Barreras Chitin La'ar Beis HaShoeva, a woman was able to sift out her flour miles away from the Beis HaMikdash because of the light that emanated from the Beis HaMikdash miles away. That's what the Gemara says. Tosfos asked the question, how am I allowed to derive benefit? How is a woman allowed to sit there and sift out the flour from the light that's coming from the Beis HaMikdash? You're not allowed to derive benefit to take pleasure from the Beis HaMikdash. Let's say one day I'm cooking in Yerushalayim, I happen to be missing a spoon, and I don't have anything to stir my pot with, so I'll go into the Beis HaMikdash, take a spoon from the Beis HaMikdash and start using it? Of course not. You're not allowed to do that. Why? because it belongs to Hekdesh, it belongs to the Beis HaMikdash, you can use it for your own private purposes. Well, so too over here, how am I allowed to derive pleasure, to derive benefit from the fact that there's light coming from the Beis HaMikdash? How am I allowed to sit there and sift out my flour miles away? Similarly, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Yuma, Daf Lametesim Beis, which is the second entry here, we're told that the Ketores had a very beautiful smell, and it was a very powerful smell that the Ketores had. And the Gemara tells us it was so powerful when you have a woman who is getting ready for her own wedding day, and she would put on all sorts of creams and perfumes and everything to make herself look beautiful. So the Gemara says, "Lahaisa kala tzricha lehisbasim biYerushalayim." A woman who was getting married never had to put artificial perfumes on herself to make herself smell good, mipnei reach haKetores, because she was so infused by the smell of the Ketores that was so beautiful, it totally took over, and she didn't have to do anything more than that. Okay, I wouldn't want to smell like, I don't know that I would want to smell like the Ketores. However, that's what the Gemara assumes. They didn't have to put on their own perfume, and that's a question that's raised as well by the Rishonim. How was a woman able to derive benefit, to derive pleasure from the Ketores, which came from the Kodesh HaKadoshim? How are you allowed to do that? And the answer that's given is along the same lines. Over here, how am I deriving pleasure? How am I deriving benefit? Am I actively going ahead and using that pleasure? No. Woman happens to be sifting out her flour. There happens to be light coming from the Beis HaMikdash. So what can you do? You're allowed to use it. Similarly, woman happens to live in Yerushalayim. She happens to be getting married tonight. She is infused with a smell from the Ketores. What can you do? She's not doing anything to actively derive that benefit. So that's the same way that we say by Haneiros Halalu Kodeshem, while you're using the candles, you're allowed to derive a benefit as long as it's a passive benefit. Just you cannot get an active benefit. Now what about making use of the sukkah on the Yom Tov of Sukkot? So the Gemara tells us in Maseches Sukkah that throughout the duration, throughout the 7 days of Sukkot, even though, yes, I know, there are more than 7 days of Sukkot, but we only sit in the Sukkah 7 days. So throughout the duration of the Yom Tov, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Sukkah, one is not allowed to derive personal pleasure from the Sukkah. And that's the way we paskin in Shulchan Aruch, in Siman Tov Reish Lamed Ches, that Atzei Sukkah, and you have either the schach of the Sukkah, or you have the walls, the panels, or the decorations of the Sukkah, you're not allowed to have any personal benefit from that. So what exactly does it mean you're not allowed to have benefit from the sukkah itself during the Yom Tov of Sukkot? That's up to a big debate. The Mishnah Berurah quotes from the Taz that let's say you have a person who derives benefit in a way where the value of the sukkah does not depreciate at all. It doesn't destroy the sukkah. It doesn't impair the sukkah at all. For example, I'm sitting in a sukkah and it's jam-packed and there's no more seats. And I'm standing for a long time. So I start to lean on the panel of the sukkah. The sukkah is not being ruined, nothing's being destroyed, but I happen to be deriving benefit from the fact that there's a sukkah here. I'm leaning on the walls. Or you take, for example, the fact that now I'm sitting in my sukkah, and the sukkah is giving me shade. That's the case with all of us, right? It's sunny outside and you get shade. So is that called really not being allowed to derive benefit from the sukkah? The answer is no. Why, says the Mishnah Berurah, quoting the Taz, that's not what it means that you're not allowed to derive benefit, derive pleasure from the sukkah itself. The Mishnah Berurah writes, over there, there's no depreciation in value at all of the sukkah. And therefore, he says, the only time you're not allowed to make use of the sukkah during the Yom Tov of Sukkot is when you're depreciating the value, or in some way you are damaging the item of the sukkah itself. That's what we assume, that's what the Taz assumes. However, there is an opinion in the Acharonim that disagrees very strongly with the Taz. And that is found in the Oneg Yontif. That's number three here, which is a very interesting approach that he has. He lived in the mid-1800s, passed away in 1879, so the Oneg Yontif strongly disagrees with the Taz. Let's read as follows. And he says, the Gemara says in Sukkah Daf Chavches Amid Beis, Tanan B'Sukkah Chavches Amid Beis, Yardu Geshamim. You know, we all know that when it rains outside, you're allowed to go inside and finish your meal indoors. We always have people who decide, well, even though it's raining, I'm going to sit outside anyway. So, what do we think about such people? So you don't have to say, what? You don't have to say, the Rama will tell us worse than you think. Says the Rama. Says the Gemara. Yordu Gishamim. Let's say it starts to rain. Me'em asai mutter lefanos. When am I allowed to take all of my plates and bring all the food inside and start my meal inside? Misha tisrach hamekafa. Which means, once my soup starts getting droplets of water in it and it's uncomfortable to eat outside, then I don't have to sit outside anymore and I should go inside. Says the Rama. Anyone who chooses under those conditions, when it's raining outside and your soup is getting ruined and everything is getting destroyed and it's not comfortable and you choose to sit there anyway, nikra hedyot. Hedyot means a fool. in layman's terms. So that's what the Ramah says, and not only that, ve'ena makabel schar. You don't gain anything. All you gain is you're ruining all your clothing. That's what the Ramah says. You don't get schar, you don't get benefit, you don't get reward, you get nothing out of that. Now, says the Onigyanta, v'kashali, I don't understand. Kimen dekai malan atse sukkah. V'kol shekein schach gufa aser b'hana kol shiva. Since we assume that a sukkah is not allowed to be used for my own pleasure, for my own benefit during the duration of the Yom Tov, while I'm using the sukkah for the mitzvah, I'm not allowed to get benefit from it for myself. Im kein, if that's true, eich mutter leishava b'shasha pater min asukkah. Ask the Onigyantiv. How am I allowed to sit in there while it's raining? Not only, says the Onigyantiv, why does the Ramah say you're called a fool and you get no credit for sitting in the sukkah while it's raining? It's much worse than that. Not only do you get no credit, not only do we call you a fool, says the Onigyantiv, it should be forbidden to sit in the sukkah. Why? Because now I'm keeping myself dry by the fact that there's a sukkah over my head. So how am I allowed to stay in the sukkah? Not just do I get points, but how am I allowed to, says the Oneg Yom Tov, if it's raining outside and this is going to help me stay dry, how am I allowed to stay in the sukkah while it's raining outside? So he goes on to argue the point, and what you see clearly is that he disagrees with the Taz, and he says, this that we assume you're not allowed to derive benefit, pleasure from a sukkah, that means even when you don't appreciate the value of the sukkah, even when I don't break off a piece of the schach and use it for my own purposes, even when I don't take a decoration from the sukkah and use it for something else, just by nature of the fact that I'm deriving pleasure and benefit from the sukkah itself, says the Oneg Yom Tov, I believe that that's already a violation of the sanctity of the sukkah. Which is a very extreme opinion, because I didn't put on here, but if you keep reading in the Oneg Yom Tov, he says, well, we all know that women are not obligated to sit in sukkah. Why? Because the mitzvah saseh shazman grama, it's a time-bound mitzvah. Women don't have to keep time-bound mitzvahs. Well, then he says, if women are not obligated, then why are they allowed to? Why are they allowed to sit in the sukkah? You're not allowed to sit in the sukkah and derive benefit if you're not obligated to sit there. So he goes so far as to say, perhaps we should say women aren't allowed to sit in the sukkah, which is not the same. Let's say women are not obligated in tkiyas shofar. Women are not obligated in shaking lulav. But we all do it, right? Everybody does it. Everyone tries their best to do it as best as they can. So why should sukkah be any different? Says the Onig Yom Tov, perhaps sukkah is different. So obviously this is not the accepted opinion at all. We assume, like the Taz says, that the only time that there's a prohibition against deriving pleasure and benefit from the sukkah is when you're depreciating the value of the sukkah, or when you're doing some sort of damage, you impair the sukkah in some way, that's when we assume you're not allowed to derive pleasure or benefit. However, in a case where it's not that way, in a case where you're just deriving passive pleasure, we assume that would be not a problem at all, as long as you are not depreciating the value of the sukkah. There's a similar discussion. Let's say everyone has different ideas of what they should hang up in the sukkah, and everyone, they're all wonderful. So some people have a practice that they hang up some hadassim, or not hadassim, beautiful smelling different fragrances. So the shaila is, am I allowed, on sukkahs, am I allowed to go and smell and derive pleasure from that which is hanging on the sukkah? Or do we assume, well, that's a violation of getting pleasure from the sukkah while it's the Yom Tov of sukkahs? So that's a big discussion in the Rishonim. Some say, well, you're not allowed to do that. It belongs to the sukkah. It's out of bounds. You're not allowed to derive any pleasure from it throughout the duration of Yom Tov. And others say, what do you mean? I'm not depreciating the value, which seems to be the very similar disagreement that the Taz and the Oneg Yom Tov are having. What is the nature of this prohibition of deriving pleasure from a sukkah? Is it only when I'm ruining the sukkah in some way? And in that case, there would be no prohibition against smelling something which is hanging from the schach, which smells nice. Or is it that I'm not allowed to derive any personal benefit from the sukkah, and therefore we would assume that the same would apply as well for hadassim that are hanging from the sukkah, that I'm not allowed to derive pleasure. Anyway, so that's while we're... This is the first category of while we're engaged in a mitzvah. Throughout the duration of Hanukkah, throughout the duration of sukkahs, you're not allowed to derive pleasure from the Hanukkah menorah, from the candles, and from the sukkah. Each one has its own parameters of what exactly that means. I did see something very interesting, which I want to point out, and that is number Dalet. The Beis Halevi writes in his Sefer on Chumash. You know, very often we have poor people that come to us because they need help. And not only do they need physical help, sometimes they just need our attention. Sometimes they just need us to speak to them. And you just got home from work and you're dead tired and all your kids are screaming and they're running out of the back and your grandchildren are screaming, whoever it is. And it's a busy time and it's dinner time and what are they coming to the house and you're all frustrated and you're annoyed and it's my one day off from work and why are they bothering me? And you don't always treat them as respectfully as you should. Says the Beis Halevi. Let's read this together because I think it gives a different perspective on what it's like, on what the experience is supposed to be like when we have the encounter with the person who's poor and needs our help. Says the Beis HaLevi, Hinei be'eish hanostim tznaka la'ani. At a time when we give charity to a poor person, v'nimtza makayim b'ha'ani mitzvos tzedaka, and we are now performing through that ani, through that vehicle, so to speak, we are now performing the mitzvah of tzedakah, but od kama mitzvos asei kemo v'chazakta, well, we are not only supporting him, but we're also giving him strength, and we're helping him out. Says the Beis HaLevi, az ha'ani hu mamish kemo b'chinas esrog b'eis shenot lo latzeis bo. Says the Beis HaLevi, he's like a mitzvah item. The same way you would never defile your esrog in the middle of Sukkot, and you would never defile your sukkah in the middle of Yom Tov or your Hanukkah candles, this ani, at the time when you're engaged in the mitzvah with him, is also like an esrog. He is like a chepza shel mitzvah. And therefore, says the Beis HaLevi, the same way you would respect every mitzvah item, so too you have to make sure to show the utmost respect to this person who is allowing you to fulfill your obligation of the mitzvah of tzedakah. How amazing, what a beautiful insight of what it is, what that opportunity is, what the experience is supposed to look like when we have an opportunity to give tzedakah and to be giving on the giving end instead of on the receiving. To notice that it's difficult enough for the person to come and ask for it, but our perspective, our attitude has to be that that person is like a chefza shel mitzvah. That person is like a beautiful esrog, that the same way I would never defile the kedusha of an esrog, I'm never allowed to compromise on the sanctity, on the dignity of a person who comes asking me for help either. You know, we shouldn't take it to an extreme. There is a story that the Maharsham tells in his Akdama to one of his Shalos HaTshuvas. So he writes that, you know, the bracha is when you see somebody who's a little bit odd-looking. So everyone has their own definition of what odd-looking is. But the halacha is that when you see somebody like that, you make a bracha Mishana Habriya. So he said that he once saw somebody, and he says, Bididi Habiyuvta. He says, I saw it with my own eyes, the Maharsham writes. So I trust him. But he said that one time he was in a big public square in a supermarket or something, and he says that everybody noticed that there was a very small midget, far in the distance. So the Maharsham writes that he saw somebody who thought he was a chassid shota, the Maharsham calls him. He was a silly person. And he thinks that he's going to be so firm and he's going to do the mitzvah as best as he can. So he you know, makes himself a pathway through all the crowds and he pushes everyone aside because he has to go make his bracha mishana habrios on the midget that he sees. So he goes and he runs to him and he picks him up. He says, Tafas also nanas kalulav. He picks up this person like a lulav and he starts having all the kavanas and he's shuckling and he's shaking and he's saying the bracha and he says, Mishana habrios, and says the Maharsham. Obviously, it's an exaggerated kind of story the way he says it, but he writes that instead of walking himself into a path of Gan Eden, he said the person just dug himself a path directly into Gehenna. At the time that he was trying to secure himself a space in Gan Eden, by saying a bracha, by reciting it with all the kavanas and shuckling and making sure to do as best as he could, he writes that he just dug himself a direct path that's going to lead him straight into Gehenna. And he writes that sometimes, even though we look at mitzvahs and we say to ourselves, well, we have to have all the kavanas and we have to do whatever we can to do them as best, to perform them as perfectly in the optimal way, at the same time, we have to be sensitive to the needs of those who are around us. And we have to be sensitive to the feelings of the people that we're dealing with. And that's exactly what the Beis HaLevi writes over here. Because every time we are granted the great opportunity to be on the giving end of a mitzvah or on the giving end of a tzedakah or whatever, to be a chesed, we should realize that that person that we're helping is like an esrog, is like a lulav, is like a chefza shel mitzvah. And we communally have an obligation to treat them the same way we would treat mitzvah items as well. That I found to be a very fascinating point that the Beis HaLevi makes. So now, we know what our attitude is supposed to be toward mitzvahs while we're performing them. So what happens after Hanukkah? Now Hanukkah's over, now we're post-Hanukkah, and the question is, what do I do with my menorah? I want to clean up the house, the whole house is a wreck, I've had Hanukkah, you know, parties every night in my house, and the kids, you know, the one thing just bothers me so much, glitter. Who created glitter? I don't know. I can't deal with it. So, you know, my kids, all the Hanukkah parties, now there's glitter all over the house. So, thank you to the grandparents. So so what happens after Hanukkah, forgetting about the glitter, she's not here today. So when you have the Hanukkah menorah and all the candles and all the wicks and all the oil, so what do you do with that? So the Medrash Tanchuma writes, a very fascinating comment, Medrash Tanchuma tells us that after Hanukkah is over, this is not the same as after Sukkot. After Hanukkah is over, somebody didn't like that, after Hanukkah is over, we assume, says the Medrash, usur to have any benefit. One is not allowed to derive any pleasure from the leftover wicks, from the leftover oil, after Hanukkah is completed. Even though my mitzvah is now on hiatus for another year. I'm not thinking about next year Hanukkah, I'm thinking about right now. So the Medrash Tanchuma writes, and this is what some Rishonim paskin, one is not allowed to derive any pleasure, any benefit from the Hanukkah candles after Hanukkah is over. And he says, Yesh l'sarfo. The practice is that you make a big fire and you burn all of it up in a big furnace. That's why many Hasidish kehilos, many Hasidish communities have that practice. The day after Hanukkah, they get together all the big, you know, they make a big bonfire out of all the wicks and all the oils that are left over, and they burn it the way the Medrash says. Now, the Ramban writes in Masechah Shabbos, I don't understand. Why shouldn't this be an exact parallelism between Sukkah and Hanukkah? The same way while I'm performing my mitzvah of Sukkah, I'm not allowed to derive benefit. So too, I'm not allowed to derive benefit while I'm performing my mitzvah of Hanukkah, of lighting the candles. Once Hanukkah is over, it should be the same halacha as once Sukkot is over. After Sukkot is over, let's take for example, I just moved into a new house, I don't have shades yet. So I want to take my schach, let's say, I want to take the schach, I want to hang it up as a shade. So am I allowed to do that or not? Well, after Sukkot is over, why not? Yes, you're allowed to do that. And if I want to use the panel of a sukkah for some wall in my house, whatever it is, you're allowed to do so. So why is it that all of a sudden when it comes to Hanukkah, the rules change? Even after Hanukkah is finished, even after I've completed my mitzvah in its entirety, we still assume that you're not allowed to derive any benefit, any pleasure from all that you used on Hanukkah. Why should that be the case? Is that clear? So the Ramban writes as follows. Let's read the Ramban together. Matzasi l'miktzas ga'anim she'amru. The Ramban writes, I have found that there are those who say, Shem kavsa ner shel Hanukkah v'nishar shemen b'ner b'yom harishon. There are some who say that if there's leftover oil, right? You know, back in the days, I think even when I was growing up, certainly when many others were growing up here, we used to pour oil from a bottle into a cup. That used to be the practice. And we used to make those floaty wicks that never worked. But we used to use those. Nowadays, nobody uses them anymore. So the Ramban says, what happens? I fill up the cup from the bottle of oil, and now there's some leftover oil because that floaty wick just didn't work. So there's some leftover the next night. So do you have to dump everything out for the second night and refill it again? No, says the Ramban. You can reuse whatever's left over from the first night and now fill it up for the second night. V'chein shar ha'yamin. V'im nishar ba b'yom ha'acharon. What if there's leftover on the last day of Hanukkah where there's nothing that you're going to use it for any longer? Osa la madura, then you make a big furnace with sarfa bimkomo, and you burn it. Shaharei huktza la mitzvasa. Because it has been set aside for a mitzvah purpose. And therefore, you're not allowed to use it for your own purposes. What does that mean? My sukkah has also been set aside for a mitzvah purpose. And after sukkah is over, my mitzvah is over, so I'm allowed to use it. So ask the Ramban, why should there be a difference between sukkah, after sukkah is that I'm allowed to use it, and Ner Chanukah, that after Chanukah, I'm seemingly not allowed to use it. Okay, obvious question, says the Ramban. In Kabbalah Hine Kabel, if this is the halacha, I accept it. However, he says, V'nomar, you have to explain as follows. D'lo dami la'atzi sukkah ulenoye sukkah shumutar ma'acharachah. There's a reason, and there's a marked distinction between Neros Chanukah and the sukkah. What's the difference? Mishum dehasam, because over there, when I construct my sukkah, what do I have in mind? I have in mind that I'm going to put up the sukkah. After sukkah is over, I'm going to take it down. And now that my mitzvah is over, the sukkah is over. However, when I put my oil into the cups to light them for Hanukkah, what do I have in mind? I don't have in mind that I'm going to use them afterward. I have in mind that all of the oil is going to burn nicely. And it's all going to be used up for the mitzvah. Therefore, says the Ramban, there's a major difference between sukkah, that after Yom Tov is over, you're certainly allowed to use it for your own purposes, and Neros Chanukah, which you would not be allowed to use the leftover oil for your own purposes. Why? Because Neros Chanukah, when I put the oil into that cup, my intent was that all the oil will be used to burn for the mitzvah. And therefore, since it's already been hukta l'mitzvah, so he calls it, it's already been set aside, designated for the mitzvah, therefore we assume one is not allowed to now revert back and use it for a private purpose after Hanukkah is over, even though now Hanukkah is over and the mitzvah is over. But still, this has already been designated for a mitzvah, and my kavana was at the time of the mitzvah that all of the oil in this cup is going to be used. That's what the Ramban writes, and therefore he explains the difference between Neros Hanukkah and the mitzvah of sukkah. Then after sukkah is over, you're allowed to derive benefit. After Hanukkah is over, you are not allowed to. The Beis Yosef, the Shulchan Aruch, writes that he thinks this is a very difficult thing to understand. because he says the Rishonim say that you have to make a fire afterwards and you're not allowed to derive benefit from the candles. At the same time, the Rush paskins la halacha, the Rush is one of the great Rishonim, the Rush paskins la halacha that after 30 minutes, a person is allowed to take the candles and put them out, and you're allowed to derive benefit from the extra oil that's left in the cup. So what do you mean? Why are you allowed to do that? Says the Beis Yosef, didn't you tell me that when you put the oil in, it's been hooked to the mitzvah, so it's been set aside for the mitzvah, so now you're not allowed to derive any pleasure, any benefit? So how do you put this all together? Explains the Beis Yosef, the answer is very obvious. We're talking about two different cases. When you have a person that puts in just the right amount of oil that could burn for 30 minutes alone, then we assume that even if it goes out, what's the halacha, let's say? It happens every so often. You light a candle, and it goes out 5 minutes later. Anyone know what's the halacha? You don't have to relight. Kavsa ein zakukla. Once I lit the candles, it's good. Even if it goes out before 30 minutes. Because I did my mitzvah. I performed my mitzvah. You know, everybody thinks you have to sit around with the candles for 30 minutes. It's not true. It's a big misnomer. It's more important to dance with your kids and to get them excited about Hanukkah than to sit and watch the candles. So when we have the candles burning for 30 minutes, that's the optimal. But what if I lit the candles and they went out after 5 minutes? I don't have to go back and relight them. Says the Beis Yosef, what happens if I only put enough oil for the 30 minutes and now there's 25 minutes left of oil left in that cup? That's when we say you're not allowed to derive benefit. But what if I fill up a cup the way we all do? You fill up the whole cup that it should burn for 3-4 hours and now you have something left. The Beis Yosef says this halacha was never stated for the extra oil that's above and beyond the 30 minutes. And he says, therefore, there would be no obligation for you to go ahead and burn the leftover oil that's above and beyond the 30 minutes. We only assume that the 30 minutes that you put in is designated for the mitzvah. Anything more is just considered a hiddur mitzvah. And he says that would not be considered a iser hana for a person to get private benefit, private pleasure from that. So nowadays, I would imagine, the reason why most of us probably do not make a fire after Hanukkah's over, I would imagine most of us in the room do not do that, is because generally when we fill up a cup of oil, we're not just putting in the bare minimum amount for 30 minutes. We're putting in a lot more than that. So therefore, the Shulchan Aruch himself writes, anything that's left over more than the 30 minutes shear would not be considered a problem, and one would be allowed to either use that or dispose of it on their own. They are not considered iser hana, that's not considered huktzah l'mitzvasa, because that was not set aside for the bare minimum amount of what you need to perform your mitzvah of Neres Chanukah. So that's with regard to that. Now the Gemara in Brachos tells us, if you look at the bottom of the first side of the sheet, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos Daf Lamites that there is an institution of recycling and reusing mitzvah items after we've already completed the first usage. For example, anyone ever wonder what's with the Erev Tavshilin? First of all, if you ask men, when do we make an Erev Tavshilin? They have no idea. Right, so when do you make an Erev Tavshilin? Which way? So which way? When Shabbos is before, Shabbos is after? Right. So no man knows the answer to that. So you should all be proud. Only when Shabbos is after Yom Tov, that's when we make an Erev Tavshilin. My father always says over the story that there was a rabbi, he made an announcement. There was a Shabbos and then 2 days of Yom Tov. So Friday night, the rabbi gets up, he makes an announcement. Everyone has to remember tonight to make an Erev Tavshilin. Somebody's visiting in the town and he says, you know, I think you're making a mistake. You only make an Erev Tavshilin when it's Shabbos after Yom Tov, not when it's Shabbos first. He said, no. The Groz Shita is that you make it even this way. You know, everyone, whenever you have some strange opinion, you say, yeah, the Vilna Gaon says that. Everyone blames it on the Vilna Gaon. So that is not the case. The halacha is you only make an Erev Tavshilin when Shabbos falls out after Yom Tov. So what happens? You make an Erev Tavshilin. Generally, our practice is make an Erev Tavshilin made out of a matzah and an egg. Where does that come from? Anyone know? Matzah and an egg. Convenience. You're pretty much right. It's close. What? Right, so you're supposed to have one bake and one cook. So why do you have a matzah instead of something else? And why do you have an egg instead of meat? Right? So the answer is, the reason why this was instituted is because you have to have something that's going to last you until Shabbos. So what item are you going to have that's going to last you until Shabbos? So a baked item, if you have matzah, it's not going to go stale. So it will last you until Shabbos, and you can rest assured that by the time Shabbos comes along, it will still be okay. And if you have an egg, also that something doesn't need refrigeration. So if you have an egg, back in the days, that's why they instituted that you should have an egg used for the Erev Tavshilin, because those are two items, both a cooked and a baked item, those are two items that are going to last 3 days until Shabbos comes along. That's why we have the practice of using an egg and a matzah. The Aruch HaShulchan points out, well, he says, nowadays that we have refrigeration, we should really use something much more enhanced than an egg. Why do we just rely on a little egg? We should really use the meat and the chicken and all the wonderful things that we have for Shabbos. Okay, so everyone does whatever they want. You'll ask your own shayla when it comes up next Yom Tov, but that's basically the story with the Erev Tavshilin. Says the Gemara, What happens in the times of the Gemara? And this is something we should think about as well. Rab Ami v'Rabasi, ki havi misrami lehu rifta de'eruva. When they had the bread from an Erev Tavshilin or from any other Erev that came to them, mevarchin alav hamotzi lechem in haaretz. They would go out of their way to use that for the meal on Shabbos. Why? Because they said to themselves, Amru, hol this avibe mitzvah chada, since we already performed one mitzvah with this piece of bread, meaning we designated it for the Erev Tavshilin, nevet be'achritit, we may as well perform another mitzvah with it and eat it now for our meal of Shabbos or Yantif. That's what they used to do. So again, make no mistake, the Erev Tavshilin should be around until Shabbos. You shouldn't eat it on Yantif itself. But once Shabbos comes along, the practice is that we try to use that matzah in part of our meal. And again, the reason why is because it's based on this Gemara. We assume that hol v'nevet b'mitzvah chada, once you perform one mitzvah activity with an item, you should try your best to recycle that item and use it again. If possible, you should use it again for another mitzvah item if that's possible. That's what the Gemara assumes. Similarly, the Mishnah Berurah writes in Hilchos Havdalah that many have the practice that after Sukkos is over, they take the hadasim that are left over, and since they have a sweet smell, they use that for the besamim. It's not just because they're cheap and they don't want to buy clothes, but it's because you're supposed to use a mitzvah item more than once if possible. Some achronim say, so what do you do after they lose their smell? It doesn't last forever, so what do you do then? So some say then you should throw them into the furnace to use them to cook for your Shabbos meal. Okay, none of us have furnaces anymore, so that's not so relevant. So after they're done, you just dispose of them. There were some who said, you know, somebody said last night, I gave the shiur last night, so a woman said to me, she thought the reason why she saves up the lulav until Pesach to throw it into the fire, right? Many have the practice that you throw the lulav and the dalad minim into the fire on Erev Pesach in order to burn the chametz. So she thought the reason why is because you're not allowed to get rid of it. That's the only way you can get rid of it. It's not the case. The reason why we stick around the lulav, some people do. My mother never let us. But the reason why some people keep the lulav around until Pesach to burn it with the chametz is, again, based on these lines that we assume, hol v'nevet b'mitzvah chada, once we already perform one mitzvah with this item, may as well keep it around to perform yet another mitzvah and burn the chametz with this very same item. And that's what some say. You know, you go to a wedding, and they always try to make up different kibudim. So you try to be mechabed as many people as you can. So nowadays our practice is that you have two people are set aside to sign the ksuba. And two people are set aside, just by the way, if you're making a wedding, it's the worst kibud in the world because you have to be there earliest. So it's just not a good idea. You're not doing anybody a favor by giving them that. So you have two people left to sign the ksuba, then two people have to be the Eid of Kiddushin, two people have to be the Eid of Yichud. So generally now, we split it up. The Tashbetz, one of the Rishonim, writes that really it should be the same person. Why? Because hol v'nevet b'mitzvah chada. Once I'm the person that's involved in the mitzvah and I'm already the Eid on the Ksuba, I may as well continue. I should be the Eid not only on the Ksuba, I should be the Eid on the Kiddushin, I should be the Eid on the Yichud, I should do everything myself. Now, that's not the practice. My father always says over that he went to a wedding, I think the Lukens family made a wedding, and they were very close with the government officials, so they invited one of the governors, one of the mayors, I don't remember what he said, and my father said that Mr. Lukens was concerned, how does he give a kibud to the governor, to the mayor, at his son's chuppah? What exactly can you come up with for that? So they were mechabed him with marching the ring down the aisle. And they told him that if you don't do a good job on this, the couple cannot get married. So he was walking around the whole night with this ring, you know, and then he marched down with a pillow like a sandik, and he brought it onto the chuppah. Anyway, so we have all sorts of kibudim. What's the reason why nowadays we don't do that? Why do we split it up and give everyone different parts of the chuppah? The reason why is because the Gemara has a concept of Berov Am Hadras Melech, which means, really means three different things in three different Gemaras. You have, I mean, it's not really exactly relevant to what we're saying, but it's an important thing to take note of. Berov Am Hadras Melech really has three different meanings, but over here, sometimes, let's say the Gemara says Imsachim, when everyone used to come and shech their Karban Pesach and Erev Pesach, so there was mayhem in the Beis HaMikdash. So what do? They have millions of karbanos that they have to shecht in a very short span of time. So the Gemara tells us that they would have an assembly line of kohanim, a line that went from the people straight to the mizbeach, and then a line that went back from the mizbeach to the people, and they would pass the cup of blood to sprinkle on the mizbeach from one to the next to the next to the next, and they would pass it back on the line to give it back to the person who was waiting there. That's what the Gemara says. Says the Gemara, they didn't only do this in order to be efficient, in order to save time, and that people shouldn't bump into each other. They did it because Berov Am Hadras Melech. When you have a mitzvah that needs to be performed, it's nice for everybody to take a small part, a small section of that mitzvah upon themselves. So therefore, if everybody takes a little piece of the mitzvah, that will be in some way an enhancement of the mitzvah itself. Let's say by a bris. You have all sorts of kibudim. Min ha-sandik, mei ha-sandik. Take from this one, give to that one, give to the other one. Why do we do that? Again, that more people should be involved That's considered in some way a Berovam Hadras Melech. It's considered to be an enhancement of the mitzvah. We have the question comes up all the time. Let's say you have young children or young grandchildren who they wear tzitzis and the tzitzis get dirty or ripped or whatever it is. So what do you do with those tzitzis? It's a major problem. What do you do with them? So let's get to that in a second. So the problem is, let's say over here the Gemara tells us if you can recycle, if you can reuse it, you should. But what if you can't? What if you have those old tzitzis? What if you have the old thing and you don't want the tzitzis lying around your house and you don't need the tzitzis as a bookmark in your books or whatever it is? So what are you going to do with it? So now what do you do with the tzitzis? Very often you have people who put them in Seamus and it clogs up the Seamus and it costs the shul money. So that's not what you're supposed to do with it. So let's see as follows. The Gemara says as follows. Is this on here? Yeah, the Gemara Megillah on Chav Vav Amud Beis. Says the Gemara Tana Rabbanan, Tashmishe Mitzvah Nizrakin, which we'll define in a minute what exactly that category means. Tashmishe Mitzvah are allowed to be disposed of. You could just toss them out in the garbage. Tashmishe Kedusha Nignazim. But we have a second category told, Tashmishe Kedusha, those need to be buried. Now says the Gemara, how do you categorize which one belongs in category 1, which one goes in category 2, which items are allowed to be disposed of and which items must be buried? Says the Gemara as follows, Eilu ein Tashmishe Mitzvah. What is in that category of mitzvah items that are allowed to be disposed of after you're done with them? Number 1, Sukkah. After the Yom Tov of Sukkot is over, my Sukkah has no more status of Kedusha, no sanctity. You can just dispose of it. The Schach, you don't want it anymore, you bought a new Schach, you can dispose of it. Lulav. Okay? Lulav, you can dispose of it. You don't have to save it up till Pesach. You're allowed to dispose of it. Shofar, which is not so relevant, we don't throw out a shofar that often. Or tzitzis, which I believe is very relevant. You have young children, they ruin the tzitzis, they get all dirty in the park or whatever it is. You don't want them wearing them anymore. So now, what do you do with it? You don't put it in the Seamus, you throw it out in the garbage. So the Rama says, what does it mean throwing it out in the garbage? It doesn't mean you throw it out with all the dirty leftovers from your dinner the night before. That's not what it means. It means you put it in a plastic bag. You're not mevazi, you're not allowed to show any disrespect of it. You can't desecrate, dishonor the mitzvah item. However, you are allowed to dispose of it by putting it in a plastic bag on its own and just tossing it into the garbage. That's good enough. That's what the Gemara tells us. And that's an important issue. Okay? Good? Now, says the Gemara, Eloein Tashmisha Kedusha. What's part of this second category called Tashmisha Kedusha that must be buried? So the Gemara tells us as follows. Number 1, Diluskime Svarim, which means when I have, you know, a sofer is writing psukim on a parchment, so you have to go and put those into Geniza if he doesn't end up using them. Now, it's not only because there's Shem Hashem on there. Let's say he writes psukim that don't have Shem Hashem. That's also called Divrei Torah, and Divrei Torah need to be put in the Seamus. Now, this is a very relevant issue. Last night, somebody raised the problem about, you know, if you have sukkah decorations that have psukim on them. And the woman didn't even realize how big of a problem it was, because there's a much bigger issue. Once you raise that issue, how many people here get wedding invitations that have psukim on them? Right? So what do you do? So if you're making a wedding invitation, do the world a favor and don't put a pasuk on there. And the reason why many people write Nala es Yerushalayim arosh simchasein is because it's not a real pasuk. That's based off of the pasuk of Imlo ala es Yerushalayim arosh simchasein. So we make a fake pasuk in order that there shouldn't be a problem of Seamus. But many people write Kol sasam v'kol simcha, kol chasam v'kol kala, whatever, you write psukim on there. So what do? If you look in the Seamus here, there's plenty of tops of, all the tops of my invitations are all in the Seamus here. And that's a big shaila. Do you really have to do that or not? My father is always very careful to, he gets thousands of invitations a year, and he's always very careful to cut off the tops if it has a pasuk, and he puts it in the Seamus. So that's a major problem. Do everyone a favor and try to stay away from that. There is a big question, let's say, that was raised by Rav Rabinowitz, who's the Rav HaKotel. So he had a fascinating question. What do you do with all the letters, with all the notes? They don't leave them there forever. I think twice a year they clean them out, Sukkot and Pesach. So what do? Can you throw them out, or do you have to put them into Geniza? Imagine, you're going to need a landfill for that thing, to collect all those letters and put them somewhere. So, you know, that was a question that was raised, and Rav Asher Weiss once told me that he was asked this question, and he suggested that, you know, even though many say that you have to bury not only Divrei Torah, but let's say you have to bury a Siddur as well, right? Of course, you have to bury a Siddur. That's called Divrei Torah also. So he said this is not the same as a Siddur. Somebody who writes a letter to God and says, please give me this, please send me a Refuah Shleima, please give me a Parnasa, please, you know, do something for my family. We don't assume that that's considered the same status as a sitter. Yes, it's a heartfelt tefillah and it's a wonderful thing, but we don't generally assume that that needs to be put in the Seamus. And whatever, I think the practice is they do it anyway, but strictly speaking, we assume you wouldn't need to do that. But all that is based on our Gemara, where the Gemara says the category of Tashmisha Kedusha is something that needs to be buried. There is a big shaila that came up, an unfortunate shaila that came up in the times of the Holocaust and throughout the generations, throughout the millennia. What happens when you have an enemy that's going to destroy your svarim? It's going to destroy your Sifrei Torah and going to destroy all the books that you consider to be sacred and holy. So are you allowed to go ahead and burn the books in order to save them from being destroyed by the enemy? So that was also a big discussion that came up throughout the generations, and it's something that we should hope and pray that it should never be relevant again for us. But all of this really stems back to this Gemara, where the Gemara tells us that the category of Tashmisha Kedusha, the first on that list, is Duluskimei Svarim. When you have the sofer, the scribe, who's writing Sifrei Torah, writing Psukim, all of those extra paragraphs, all those extra parchment that he has, must be buried and put in Shemus. Similarly, the Gemara says an old pair of tefillin, or mezuzah, tikshel Sefer Torah, not only a Sefer Torah itself, but also if I have the mantle of a Sefer Torah, that also needs to be buried. Vinar tikshel tefillin, this happens very often. You have somebody who gets a new tefillin bag, what do you do with the old one? So the Gemara says that you have to put the old one in the Shemus. Now, nowadays it's not really the case, because nowadays we put the tefillin first in a box, and then you put the tefillin in a bag. So the bag is really what we call tashmish to tashmish. It's twice removed from the tefillin itself. So nowadays I think a tefillin case is not the same as it used to be. It used to be they just took the bare tefillin, put it into the bag, and that's what has the tefillin. So nowadays it might be a little different. Anyway, the question is, how does the Gemara come to this distinction? How does the Gemara decide what is considered a part of the category of tashmishei mitzvah? Just a mitzvah item that's allowed to be disposed of, tossed out into the garbage. And when do I assume that something is in the category of tashmishei kedusha, that it needs to be buried? Where do you draw the line? And how do you figure out what category, what item is in which category? So my father writes as follows. He writes from Rav Soloveitchik a very important idea. It's a very fundamental idea, which explains many different things, which we're not going to get into, but I think just for the basis, we can understand what he writes. So he suggests as follows. Uvigeder ha-hevdel, let's read it together, number ches. Uvigeder ha-hevdel shebein tashmishei mitzvah lebein tashmishei kedusha. When we're trying to figure out what is the distinction, what is the difference, how do you draw the line between something which is in category A, called tashmishei mitzvah, and category B, called tashmishei kedusha, which must be buried? Bi'ir b'sefer nefesh ha-chaim. Rav Chaim Volozhiner explains in the Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, the yesod kol inyanei kedusha hu kedusha satorah. What infuses anything in the world with kedusha, with sanctity, is only the Torah itself. The only way something can become kadosh in this world is through the Torah itself. V'hainu time of the Sefer Torah tefillin and mezuzah. That's why in the category B of tashmishei kedusha, which must be buried, we assume, what's in that category? Sefer Torah, tefillin, mezuzah, all of those have divrei Torah. And not only that, the mantle which wraps around the Sefer Torah, also, that's considered housing divrei Torah. Shekulam yesh behem kedushas ksav shel Torah. All of those have an elevated status of consecration, of divinity, because they have divrei Torah written on them. Oshei mishamshim leksav shel Torah. Or they are helping to house something which has divrei Torah. Kinar tikshel Sefer Torah v'kishel tefillin, like the tefillin bag, or like the mantle of a Sefer Torah. Aval, however, besukah, lulav, shofar, and tzitzis, those don't have any divrei Torah on them. A sukkah just is a sukkah, and a shofar is just a shofar, and a tzitzis is just a pair of tzitzis. It doesn't have any Torah on it, and therefore we assume that that can be disposed of. That does not have any intrinsic level of kedusha. There's no sanctity to that. Once your mitzvah is over, that's why you're allowed to dispose of it. So this is the way Reb Chaim Volozhiner explains what kedusha is. Now he brings it to another paragraph, which is, I put it together here. My father writes this in another place, but it's also along the same lines. What is the point of sanctity of a shul or of a Beis HaMikdash? What gives sanctity to a shul? You know, very often we have breakaway minyanim in people's basements. So people say, what's the problem? There's a minyan there anyway. Why can't I daven there? I'm davening with a minyan. So you say, what, just because I'm not coming to shul, what do you care? I can daven wherever I want. Well, the answer is, not every place where people meet to daven is considered a Beis HaKnesses. What gives something a status of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses? When you have a Sefer Torah. So that's what, look at the next paragraph. B'yesod Kedushas Beis HaMikdash Beis HaKnesses. What elevates a room to now have a status of a consecrated room, of a divine room, of a sanctified room, of a Beis HaKnesses or a Beis HaMikdash? What gives it that elevated status? So Rav Soloveitchik explained, Ulefi HaGdara Zu, Sarach Lavin, my timing is Kedusha LeBeis HaMikdash, or LeBeis HaKnesses. What gives the sanctity to a Beis HaMikdash or a Beis HaKnesses? V'shamati Mizeh Mikvod Merabbeinu HaGrit Salavetchik. My father writes from the Rav Salavetchik. The Ikar Shal HaMishkan Haya Ha'aronim HaLuchos. What sanctified the Beis HaMikdash? The Aron with the Luchos. That's the only reason why the Beis HaMikdash is considered holy, is because it houses the Aron, which houses the Luchos. V'asher Alkein. And because that is the fundamental element of Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash, that's why it's called Mishkan HaEdus, referring to the Luchos, because that is the whole consecration of the Mishkan and the Beis HaMikdash, from the fact that we have a Luchos there. Al Shem Luchos HaEdus. Ah, so you'll ask the question. Anybody know what the question is? Second Beis HaMikdash. Gemara says in Yuma, second Beis HaMikdash didn't have the Luchos. So what was the point? Why do we have a Beis HaMikdash at all? If you're not going to have any consecration, if it's not going to be sanctified, then why do I need it? That's the question. The answer is, you look in the Rambam, you know, the Rambam is a very strict book of code of law. The Rambam tells us everything, what to do under these circumstances, those circumstances, this question comes up, that. All of a sudden, the Rambam in Hilchos Beis HaMikdash goes on a tangent. He starts telling us the history and what happened when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the second one was destroyed. And over there, in the midst of his discussion, he says, well, after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, they took the Aron and the Luchos and they buried them under the ground right in the place of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, and that's where it remained. So everybody asks, what do you mean? The Rambam all of a sudden is digressing, telling us a historical fact that they were buried underneath the ground of the Beis HaMikdash? Rav Soloveitchik explained, no. The Rambam is telling you that in order to understand what gave the second Beis HaMikdash any level of sanctity. How could it be sanctified if there's no Aron and there's no Luchos? What is special about the Beis HaMikdash? Just because we all gather together there? Just because we bring karbanos? That's not a reason why the Beis HaMikdash is sanctified. The only sanctity that a Beis HaMikdash has is because of the fact that it houses the Aron and it houses the Luchos. And therefore, in Bayis Sheni, like you so correctly pointed out, in Bayis Sheni, when there was no Aron and there was no Luchos, the Rambam has to explain to us, why is it that we still consider that place to be a Makom Kadosh? And the answer, says the Rambam, is because they were hidden underneath the ground. And because of that, it still allowed this place to have a somewhat special level of sanctity, somewhat special consecration, because there were still an element of the Aron and the Luchos buried under the ground over there, which left over an impression, an impact of Kedusha into that place. This is the way Rav Soloveitchik explained as well what imparted Eretz Yisrael with its Kedusha. You'll say, well, it's the Eretz HaNevcheres, God chose the land and it's a wonderful land. Yeah, but what gave it its Kedusha? Just because Avraham Avinu looked at it? Just because Moshe Rabbeinu put his eyes on it? No. Soloveitchik said the reason why is because Yehoshua ben Nun, when he went out to fight the battle, always went out with the Aron and the Luchos. Every battle that was fought to conquer the land of Eretz Yisrael was always fought with the Torah itself, because that's the only thing that could give sanctity to a place, to a land. And therefore, when Yehoshua ben Nun fought the battles to conquer the land, the only way he did it was having the Torah and the Luchos together with him, because that is what endowed the Jewish people with the Kedusha. That's what endowed Eretz Yisrael with the Kedusha. Along these lines, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about the mitzvah of Kvura. For those who remember, we said, when you talk about burying somebody in Eretz Yisrael, so there's a special mitzvah, both Jews and non-Jews alike, we assume in Eretz Yisrael, V'lo satame asad mascha, the pasuk says in Kiseitza, you're not allowed to have the defilement of the land, and therefore we assume that it's considered the satame asad mascha, whether you have a Jewish dead body or a non-Jewish dead body, one must make sure to bury both of them equally in Eretz Yisrael, because we don't want the land to be defiled. Which raised a major question in the early 1900s when they wanted to build a medical school in Haifa. So how are you allowed to do that if you're going to have cadavers lying around? That's a violation of Lo Satame Asad Mascha. So perhaps you're not allowed to have a medical school in Eretz Yisrael. This is a major question. Major shaila. It's not such a simple answer. Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalap wrote a whole tshuva about it where he argued very fiercely that one is not allowed to have a medical school in Eretz Yisrael because you're actively violating, even though it's for a good purpose, but you're actively violating the halacha of Lo Satame Asad Mascha. At the same time, imagine if we don't have a medical school and we always have to go and outsource and get doctors from everywhere else, it would be a major problem. We wouldn't be able to have a functioning society. So that's a major question with regard to that. But we mentioned then that when it comes to Chutz La'aretz, so we only have an obligation to bury Jewish dead bodies. We do not have a strict obligation to bury non-Jewish dead bodies. Now, that being said, the question is why? What are you going to say? Because every Jew is so righteous? And every non-Jew is not righteous? That's not true. That's not true. First of all, it's not true on both accounts. Number one, it's not true that every Jew is so righteous. Plenty of Jews who are not righteous at all. And it's not true that every non-Jew is not righteous. Of course we know there are plenty of righteous non-Jews who do wonderful things in their lives, who are Bali Chesed or doing mitzvahs all their lives. So why is it that we have an obligation only to bury a Jewish dead body and not the body of a non-Jew? Explainer of Soloveitchik, the reason why is along the same lines. Because the only thing that gives sanctity to a person is the Torah. A Jewish person has the Kedushas HaTorah. Because we were given the Torah, yes, we perform mitzvahs and they perform mitzvahs. But what's the halacha with the sukkah after it's done? Dispose of it. You don't have to bury it. So what's the halacha when a mitzvah, when a non-Jewish body, he's done with all of his mitzvahs, like a sukkah. Yes, during his lifetime, while he's doing mitzvahs, he's a wonderful person. And he's elevated himself to become even more wonderful by doing all the wonderful acts of kindness, all the chesed, all the tzedakah, all the unbelievable acts that he's done throughout his lifetime. But once the lifetime is over, that's like a sukkah, that's like a lulav. It's over. You don't have to bury it. When it comes to a Jew who embodies the Kedushas HaTorah, when it comes to a Jew who embraces, who typifies, who exhibits everything that the Torah stands for, then we assume that needs to be buried the same way a Sefer Torah needs to be buried after we're done with it, after it no longer is in use. The Gemara says when somebody passes away, the Gemara tells us in Moed Katan, if somebody happens to be present at the Shas Yetzias HaNeshama, if you happen to be there when the Neshama is being lost, when the person loses their life, Chayiv Lekroa, you're obligated to rip your clothing at that point. Why? The same way, if you would see a Sefer Torah Shenisraf, if you would see a Sefer Torah that was burning, you would have to rip Kriya. So too, says the Gemara, you have to rip Kriya when you see the loss of a Jewish body. Why? Because we assume that a Jewish person is the embodiment of a Sefer Torah. We assume that a Jewish person incorporates the values of what a Sefer Torah is. And not only that, the Gemara says in Kiddushin, how do you know you have to stand up for a Sefer Torah? Says the Gemara, if you have to stand up for the people that learn and study and follow the Torah, then certainly you have to stand up for the Torah itself. And then the Gemara goes in the opposite direction. The Gemara in Makos Daf Chaf Beis, the Gemara tells us, Kama tipshi ani inshi, how foolish people are. Dimekami mekami Sefer Torah, you open up the Aron Kodesh, everybody stands up. Wala mekami mekami gavarabba. Somebody who embodies, somebody whose whole life is a walking Sefer Torah, somebody who does everything al pi haTorah throughout their lifetime, we don't respect them? You think it's more important to stand up for the Sefer Torah? We are more sanctified. We are more elevated than the Sefer Torah itself because we have everything that the Sefer Torah has, plus more. And therefore the Gemara assumes that we have an obligation to stand up for a person more so than we have an obligation to stand up for the Torah itself. Because a Jew is considered like a Sefer Torah. You know, the Divrei Chaim, the Sanzer Rav, writes in his tshuva, says, everybody knows if a Sefer Torah falls on the floor, Bizayin Sefer Torah, you got to fast, and we get all these shilas, and it happened, just happened a few weeks ago, again, not here, but somewhere else. And they have all the questions, what happens if it's on Shabbos, what if it's on Yom Tov, and what are they, how many people have to fast, what if I didn't really see, I only saw afterward, and I saw the person pick it up, everyone has all the questions. Says the Divrei Chaim, and how careful are we about Bizayin Bnei Adam? How careful are we when somebody is embarrassed? Do we talk about all the questions about how many days we have to fast when we embarrass somebody in public? When we write a nasty comment about them online? When we're malbim p'nei chaver b'ram, do we write about that? Do we ask a shayla about how many days we need to fast in order to make up for what we've just done? Fascinating point. If we assume that there's an equation between a Sefer Torah and a human being, and not only that, if we assume that a human being is more than a Sefer Torah, then why do we ask all these shaylas about a Sefer Torah that's nivzeh, that comes to a state of bizayon? What about a human being? That, says the Divrei Chaim, should be taking up a lot more of our attention. And that's something we should be thinking about as well. And I believe the same way that a Sefer Torah chaser, even if you have a Sefer Torah that's missing letters, even if you have a Sefer Torah that has parshios taken out, it still has an elevated level of Kedusha. That's the same by the Jewish people as well. Even if you have people who are chaserim, you have people who are missing a whole lot in their lives, you have people who aren't living up to the standard that you think they should be living. And you have people who aren't as observant as you would expect them to be or you would want them to be. You have people who knew better and now are not keeping to what they knew before. The same way a Sefer Torah Shechaser demands our respect, well, a human being is the same way. And it doesn't matter where they're holding, it doesn't matter what we think of them. They also are the embodiment of a Sefer Torah. That's what a Jewish person is. And this set of Soloveitchik is what it means, that we have a mitzvah of kvura for a human being, the same way we have a mitzvah of kvura for a Sefer Torah. Because that's what a Jew is all about. A Jew is about being a walking embodiment of a Sefer Torah, of taking all of its values, of being a model, of showing the world what it means to exhibit the Torah values and what it means to live a life based on the Torah. So this is basically, I think, the understanding of what we're supposed to do with mitzvah items. Just to quickly recap, again, we had a few categories. Category number one is when you have a mitzvah item while you're still using it, we assume you're not allowed to derive personal pleasure, personal benefit. Category number two is, let's say the mitzvah is now over, and now I can use it for something else, let's say like an Erev Tavshilin, so we assume one should try their best to recycle, to reuse the mitzvah item for another purpose that's of use. What if that's not possible anymore, and now the hadassim don't smell any longer, or this doesn't, you know, you can't do anything? So then we have the two categories of Tashmisha Mitzvah and Tashmisha Kedusha. Tashmisha Kedusha is anything that has Kedushas Haksav Shel Torah, anything that has Torah written on it, we assume has to be buried. However, Tashmisha Mitzvah is something which is just a mitzvah item. For example, shofar, lulav, tzitzis, or menorah, something of that nature, we assume that doesn't have an intrinsic Kedusha, and one would be allowed to dispose of it. Like the Ramah said again, disposing of it doesn't mean you put it out together with all the dirty leftovers. It means you could put it into a bag and throw it directly into the garbage.